Sound Editions presents Iron John, a book about men, by Robert Bly. Read for you by the author.
Iron John, a book about men. We are living at an important and fruitful moment now. For it is clear to men that the images of adult manhood given by the popular culture are worn out. A man can no longer depend on them. By the time a man is 35, he knows that the images of the right man, the tough man, the true man, which he received in high school, do not work in life. Such a man is open to visions of what a man is or could be. The hearth and fairy stories have passed as water through 50 feet of soil, through generations of men and women, and we can trust their images more than, say, those invented by Hans Christian Andersen. The images the old stories give, stealing the key from under the mother's pillow, picking up a golden feather fallen from the burning breast of the firebird, finding the wild man under the lake water, following the tracks of one's own wound through the forest and finding that it resembles the tracks of a god, these are meant to be taken slowly into the body. They continue to unfold once taken in. It is in the old myths that we hear, for example, of Zeus energy, that positive leadership energy in men, which popular culture constantly declares does not exist. From King Arthur, we learn the value of the male mentor in the lives of young men. We hear from the Iron John story the importance of moving from the mother's realm to the father's realm. And from all initiation stories, we learn how essential it is to leave our parental expectations entirely and find a second father or a second king. There is male initiation, female initiation, and human initiation. In the following text, I will be talking about male initiation only. I want to make clear that this work does not seek to turn men against women, nor to return men to the domineering mode that has led to repression of women and their values for centuries. The thought in this work does not constitute a challenge to the women's movement. The two movements are related to each other, but each moves on a separate timetable. The grief in men has been increasing steadily since the start of the Industrial Revolution, and the grief has reached a depth now that cannot be ignored. The dark side of men is clear. Their mad exploitation of earth resources, devaluation and humiliation of women, obsession with tribal warfare are undeniable. Genetic inheritance contributes to their obsessions, but also culture and environment. We have defective mythologies that ignore masculine depth of feeling, assign men a place in the sky instead of earth, teach obedience to the wrong powers, work to keep men boys, and entangle both men and women in systems of industrial domination that exclude both matriarchy and patriarchy. I speak of the wild man on this tape, and the distinction between the savage man and the wild man is crucial throughout. The savage mode does great damage to soul, earth, and humankind. We can say that though the savage is wounded, he prefers not to examine it. The wild man, who has examined his wound, resembles a Zen priest or a shaman or a woodsman more than a savage. The knowledge of how to build a nest in a bare tree, how to fly to the wintering place, how to perform the mating dance, all of this information is stored in a bird in the reservoirs of its instinctual brain. But human beings, sensing how much flexibility they might need in meeting new situations, decided to store this sort of knowledge outside the instinctual systems. And they stored it in fairy stories. Stories, then, fairy stories, legends, myths, hearth stories, amount to a reservoir where we keep new ways of responding that we can adopt when the conventional and current ways wear out. Now, we talk a great deal about the American man, as if there were some constant quality that remains stable over decades or even within a single decade. The men who live today have veered far away from the Saturnian, old-man-minded farmer, proud of his introversion, who arrived in New England in 1630, willing to sit through three services in an unheated church. In the South, an expansive, mother-bound cavalier developed, and neither of these two American men resembled the greedy railroad entrepreneur that later developed in the Northeast, nor the reckless I-will-do-without-culture settlers of the West. Even in our own era, the agreed-on model has changed dramatically. During the 50s, for an example, an American character appeared with some consistency that became a model of manhood adopted by many men, namely the 50s male. He got to work early, labored responsibly, supported his wife and children, and admired discipline. Reagan is a sort of mummified version of this dogged type. This sort of man didn't see women's souls well, but he appreciated their bodies. And his view of culture and America's part in it was boyish and optimistic. Many of his qualities were strong and positive, but underneath the charm and bluff, there was, and still remains, much isolation, deprivation, and passivity. Unless he has an enemy, he isn't sure that he's alive. During the 60s, another sort of man appeared. The waste and violence of the Vietnam War made men question whether they knew what an adult male really was. If manhood meant Vietnam, did they want any part of it? Meanwhile, the feminist movement encouraged men to actually look at women, forcing them to become conscious of concerns and sufferings that the 50s male labored to avoid. As men began to examine women's history and women's sensibilities, some men began to notice what was called their feminine side and to pay attention to it. This process continues to this day, and I would say that most contemporary men are involved in it in some way. There's something wonderful about this development. I mean, the practice of men welcoming their own feminine consciousness and nurturing it. This is important, and yet I have the sense that there is something wrong. The male in the past 20 years has become more thoughtful and more gentle, but by this process he has not become more free. In the 70s, I began to see all over the country a phenomenon that we might call the soft male. Sometimes even today, when I look out in an audience, perhaps half the young males are what I'd call soft. They're lovely, valuable people. I like them. They're not interested in harming the earth or starting wars. There's a gentle attitude toward life and their whole being and style of living. But many of these men are not happy. You quickly notice the lack of energy in them. They are life-preserving, but not exactly life-giving. Ironically, you often see these men with strong women who positively radiate energy. I first learned about the anguish of so-called soft men when they told their stories in early men's gatherings. In 1980, the Lama community in New Mexico asked me to teach a conference for men only, their first, in which about 40 men participated. Each day we concentrated on one Greek god and one old story, and then late in the afternoons we gathered to talk. When the younger men spoke, it was not uncommon for them to be weeping within 5 minutes. The amount of grief and anguish in these younger men was astounding to me. Part of their grief rose out of remoteness from their fathers, which they felt keenly, but partly, too, grief flowed from trouble in their marriages or relationships. They had learned to be receptive, but receptivity wasn't enough to carry their marriages through troubled times. In every relationship, something fierce is needed once in a while. Both the man and the woman need to have it. But at the point when it was needed, often the young man came up short. He was nurturing, but something else was required for his relationship and for his life. The journey many American men have taken into softness or receptivity or, quote, development of the feminine side, unquote, has been an immensely valuable journey, but more travel lies ahead. No stage is the final stop. One of the fairy tales that speak of a third possibility for men, a third mode, is a story called Iron John or Iron Hans. Though it was first set down by the Grimm brothers around 1820, this story could be 10 or 20,000 years old. As the story starts, we find that something strange has been happening in a remote area of the forest near the king's castle. When hunters go into this area, they disappear and never come back. 20 others go after the first group and do not come back. In time, people begin to get the feeling that there's something weird in that part of the forest and, quote, they don't go there anymore, unquote. One day, an unknown hunter shows up at the castle and says, what can I do? Anything dangerous to do around here? The king says, well, I could mention the forest, but there's a problem. The people who go there don't come back. The return rate is not good. Oh, that's just the sort of thing I like, the young man says. So he goes into the forest, and interestingly, he goes there alone, taking only his dog. The young man and his dog wander about in the forest, and they go past a pond. Suddenly, a hand reaches up from the water, grabs the dog, and pulls it down. The young man doesn't respond by becoming hysterical. He merely says, this must be the place. Fond as he is of his dog, and reluctant as he is to abandon him, the hunter goes back to the castle, rounds up three more men with buckets, and then comes back to the pond to bucket out the water. Anyone who's ever tried it will quickly note that such bucketing is very slow work. In time, what they find lying in the bottom of the pond is a large man covered with hair from head to foot. The hair is reddish. It looks a little like rusty iron. They take the man back to the castle and imprison him. The king puts him in an iron cage in the courtyard, calls him Iron John, and gives the key into the keeping of the queen. Let's stop the story here for a second. When a contemporary man looks down into his psyche, he may, if conditions are right, find under the water of his soul, lying in an area no one has visited for a long time, an ancient hairy man. The mythological systems associate hair with the instinctive and the sexual and the primitive. What I'm suggesting, then, is that every modern male has, lying at the bottom of his psyche, a large, primitive being covered with hair down to his feet. Making contact with this wild man is the step the 80s male or the 90s male has yet to take. That bucketing out process has yet to begin in our contemporary culture. As the story suggests very delicately, there's more than a little fear around this hairy man, as there is around all change. When a man begins to develop the receptive side of himself and gets over his initial skittishness, he usually finds the experience to be wonderful. He gets to write poetry and go out and sit by the ocean. He doesn't have to be on top in sex anymore. He becomes empathetic. It's a new, humming, surprising world. But going down through water to touch the wild man at the bottom of the pond is quite a different matter. The being who stands up is frightening. And seems even more so now, when the corporations do so much work to produce the sanitized, hairless, shallow man. When a man welcomes his responsiveness, or what we sometimes call his internal woman, he often feels warmer, more companionable, more alive. But when he approaches what I'll call the, quotation mark, deep male, unquote, he feels risk. Welcoming the hairy man is scary and risky, and it requires a different kind of courage. Contact with Iron John requires a willingness to descend into the male psyche and accept what's down there, including the nourishing dark. Now back to the story. One day the king's 8-year-old son is playing in the courtyard with a golden ball that he loves, and it rolls into the wild man's cage. If the young boy wants the ball back, he's going to have to approach the hairy man and ask for it. But this is going to be a problem. The golden ball reminds us of that unity of personality we had as children, a kind of radiance or wholeness before we split into male and female, rich and poor, bad and good. The ball is golden as the sun is, and round. Like the sun, it gives off a radiant energy from the inside. We notice that the boy is 8. All of us, whether boys or girls, lose something around the age of 8. If we still have the golden ball in kindergarten, we lose it in grade school. Whatever is still left, we lose in high school. Whether we are male or female, once the golden ball is gone, we spend the rest of our lives trying to get it back. The Iron John story proposes that the golden ball lies within the magnetic field of the wild man, which is a very hard concept for us to grasp. We have to accept the possibility that the true radiant energy in the male does not hide in, reside in, or wait for us in the feminine realm, nor in the macho John Wayne realm, but in the magnetic field of the deep masculine, it is protected by the instinctive one who's underwater and who has been there we don't know how long. Most men want some nice person to bring the ball back, but the story hints that we won't find the golden ball in the force field of an Asian guru, or even the force field of a gentle Jesus. Our story is not anti-Christian, but pre-Christian by 1,000 years or so, and its message is still true. Getting the golden ball back is incompatible with certain kinds of conventional tameness and niceness. The first step amounts to approaching the cage and asking for the golden ball back. Some men are ready to take that step, while others haven't yet bucketed the water out of the pond. They haven't left the collective male identity and gone out into the unknown area alone or gone only with their dog. The story says that after the dog, in quotes, goes down, unquote, one has to start to work with buckets. No giant is going to come along and suck all the water out for you. That magic stuff is not going to help. And a weekend at Esalen won't do it. Acid or cocaine won't do it. The man has to do it bucket by bucket. This resembles the slow discipline of art. It's the work that Rembrandt did, that Picasso and Yeats and Rilke and Bach did. Bucket work implies much more discipline than most men realize. Jung remarked that all successful requests to the psyche involve deals. The psyche likes to make deals. If a part of you, for example, is immensely lazy and doesn't want to do any work, a flat-out New Year's resolution won't do any good. The whole thing will go better if you say to your lazy part, "You let me work for an hour, then I'll let you be a slob for an hour. Is that a deal?" So, in Iron John, a deal is made. The wild man agrees to give the golden ball back if the boy opens a cage. The boy, apparently frightened, runs off. He doesn't even answer. Isn't that what happens? We have been told so often by parents, ministers, grade school teachers, high school principals, that we should have nothing to do with the wild man, that when he says, "I'll return the ball if you let me out of the cage," we don't even reply. Maybe 10 years pass now. On the second day, the man could be 25. He goes back to the wild man and says, "Could I have my ball back?" The wild man says, "Yes, if you let me out of the cage." Actually, just returning to the wild man a second time is a marvelous thing. Some men never come back at all. The 25-year-old man hears the sentence all right, but by now he has 2 Toyotas and a mortgage, maybe a wife and a child. How can he let the wild man out of the cage? The man usually walks away the second time also, without saying a word. Now 10 more years pass. Let's say the man is now 35. Have you ever seen the look of dismay on the face of a 35-year-old man? Feeling overworked, alienated, empty, he asked the wild man with full heart this time, "Could I have my golden ball back?" Yes, the wild man says, "if you let me out of my cage." Now something marvelous happens in the story. The boy speaks to the wild man and continues the conversation. He says, "Even if I wanted to let you out, I couldn't because I don't know where the key is." That's so good. By the time we are 35, we don't know where the key is. It isn't exactly that we've forgotten. We never knew where it was in the first place. The story says that when the king locked up the wild man, he gave the key into the keeping of the queen. But we were only about 7 then. And in any case, our father never told us what he had done with it. So, where is the key? The wild man replies, "The key is under your mother's pillow." Getting the key back from under the mother's pillow is a troublesome task. Freud, taking advice from a Greek play, says that a man should not skip over the mutual attraction between himself and his mother, if he wants a long life. The mother's pillow, after all, lies near where she makes love to your father. Moreover, there's another implication attached to the pillow. Michael Mead, the storyteller, once remarked to me that the pillow is also the place where the mother stores all her expectations of you. She dreams, "My son the doctor, my son the Jungian analyst, my son the Wall Street genius." But very few mothers dream, "My son the wild man." Attacking the mother, confronting her, shouting at her, which some Freudians are prone to urge us on, probably does not accomplish much. She may just smile and talk to you with her elbow on the pillow. So the key has to be stolen. I recall talking to an audience of men and women once about this problem of stealing the key. A young man, obviously well-trained in New Age modes of operation, said, "Robert, I'm disturbed by this idea of stealing the key. Stealing isn't right. Couldn't a group of us just go to the mother and say, 'Mom, could I have the key back?'" His model was probably consensus work, the way the staff at the health food store settles things. I felt the souls of all the women in the room rise up in the air to kill him. Men like that are as dangerous to women as they are to men. No mother worth her salt would give the key away anyway. If the son can't steal it, he doesn't deserve it. Mothers are intuitively aware of what happens if he got the key. They would lose their boys. The possessiveness that mothers typically exercise on sons, not to mention the possessiveness that fathers typically exercise on daughters, can never be underestimated. We could spend days talking about how to steal the key in a practical way. The story itself leaves everything open and simply says, one day he stole the key, brought it to the wild man's cage, and opened the lock. As he did so, he pinched one of his fingers. That detail will become important in the next part of this story. The wild man is then free at last, and it's clear that he will go back to his own forest, far from the castle. The boy in our story, or the 35-year-old man in our mind, however you want to look at it, now does something marvelous. He speaks to the wild man once more and says, "Wait a minute! If my parents come home and find you gone, they will beat me." That sentence makes the heart sink, particularly if we know something about child-rearing practices that have prevailed for a long time in Northern Europe. As Alice Miller reminds us in her book, For Your Own Good, child psychologists in 19th-century Germany warned parents especially about exuberance. Exuberance in a child is bad, and at the first sign of it, parents should be severe. Exuberance implies that the wild man or girl is no longer locked up. "If they come home and find you gone, they will beat me," the boy says. The wild man says, in effect, "That's good thinking. You'd better come with me." So the wild man lifts the boy up on his shoulders, and together they go off into the woods. That's decisive. We should all be so lucky. As the boy leaves for the forest, he has to overcome, at least for the moment, his fear of wildness, irrationality, hairiness, intuition, emotion, the body, and nature. Iron John is not as primitive as the boy imagines, but the boy, or the mind, doesn't know that yet. Still, the clean break with the mother and father, which the old initiators call for, now has taken place. Iron John says to the boy, "You'll never see your mother and father again, but I have treasures more than you'll ever need." So, that is that. The moment the boy leaves with Iron John is the moment in ancient Greek life when the priest of Dionysius accepted a young man as a student, or the moment in Eskimo life today when the shaman, sometimes entirely covered with the fur of wild animals, appears in the village and takes the boy away for spirit instruction. In our culture, there's no such moment. The boys in our culture have a continuing need for initiation into male spirit, but old men in general don't offer it. The priest sometimes tries, but he's too much a part of the corporate village these days. The fault of the nuclear family today isn't so much that it's crazy and full of double binds. That's true in communes and corporate offices too, in fact, in any group. The fault is that the old men outside the nuclear family no longer offer an effective way for the son to break his link with his parents without doing harm to himself. The ancient societies believed that a boy becomes a man only through ritual and effort, only through, quote, active intervention of the older men, unquote. It's becoming clear to us that manhood doesn't happen by itself. It doesn't happen just because we eat Wheaties. The active intervention of the older men means that the older men welcome the younger man into the ancient, mythologized, instinctual male world. Once that welcoming has been done, the older men teach him the myths, stories, and songs that embody distinctly male values. I mean, not competitive values only, but spiritual values. Once these, quote, moistening, unquote, myths are learned, the myths themselves lead the young male far beyond his personal father and into the moistness of the swampy fathers who stretch back century after century. In the absence of old man's labor consciously done, what happens? Initiation of Western men has continued for some time in an altered form even after fanatics destroyed the Greek initiatory schools. During the 19th century, grandfathers and uncles lived in the house, and older men mingled a great deal. Through hunting parties and work that men did together in farms and cottages, through local sports, older men spent much time with younger men and brought knowledge of male spirit and soul to them. Much of that chance or incidental mingling has ended. Men's clubs and societies have steadily disappeared. Grandfathers live in Phoenix or the old people's homes. And many boys experience only the companionship of other boys their age, who, from the point of view of the old initiators, know nothing at all. During the 60s, some young men drew strength from women, who in turn had received some of their strength from the women's movement. One could say that many young men in the 60s tried to accept initiation from women. But only men can initiate men, as only women can initiate women. So, what can be done? Thousands and thousands of women, being single parents, are raising boys with no adult man in the house. The difficulties inherent in that situation came up one day in Evanston when I was giving a talk on initiation of men to a group made up mostly of women. Women who are raising sons alone were extremely alert to the dangers of no male model. One woman declared that she realized about the time her son got to high school age that he needed more hardness than she could naturally give. But, she said, if she made herself harder to meet that need, she would lose touch with her own femininity. I mentioned the classic solution in many traditional cultures, which is to send the boy to his father when he's 12. Several women said flatly, "No, men aren't nurturing. They wouldn't take care of him." Many men, however, and I am one of them, have found inside an ability to nurture that didn't appear until it was called for. Even when a father is living in the house, there still may be a strong covert bond between mother and son to evict the father, which amounts to a conspiracy, and conspiracies are difficult to break. One woman with two sons had enjoyed going each year to a convention in San Francisco with her husband, the boys being left at home. But one spring, having just returned from a woman's retreat, she felt like being private and said to her husband, "Why don't you take the boys this year?" So the father did. The boys around 10 or 12 had never, as it turned out, experienced their father's company without the mother's presence. After that experience, they asked for more time with their dad. When the convention time rolled around the following spring, the mother once more decided on privacy, and the boys once more set off with their father. The moment they arrived back home, the mother happened to be standing in the kitchen, with her back to the door, and the older of the two boys walked over and put his arms around her from the back. Without even intending it, her body reacted explosively, and the boy flew across the room and bounced off the wall. When he picked himself up, she said, their relationship had changed. Something irrevocable had happened. She was glad about the change, and the boy seemed surprised and a little relieved that he apparently wasn't needed by her in the old way. Another woman told a story in which the mother-son conspiracy was broken from the boy's side. She was a single parent of a son and two daughters, and the girls were doing well, but the boy was not. At 14, the boy went to live with his father, but he stayed only a month or so and then came back. When he returned, the mother realized that three women in the house amounted to an overbalance of feminine energy for the son, but what could she do? A week or two went by. One night, she said to her son, "John, it's time to come to dinner." She touched him on the arm, and he exploded, and she flew against the wall. The same sort of explosion as in the earlier story. We notice no intent of abuse either time, and no evidence that the event was repeated. In each case, the psyche or body knew what the mind didn't. When the mother picked herself up off the floor, she said, "It's time for you to go back to your father." And the boy said, "You're right." The traditional initiation break is preferable and sidesteps the violence. But all over the country now, one sees hulking sons acting ugly in the kitchen and talking rudely to their mothers, and I think it's an attempt to make themselves unattractive. If the old men haven't done their work to interrupt the mother-son unity, what else can the boys do to extricate themselves but to talk ugly? It's quite unconscious, and there's no elegance in it at all. A clean break from the mother is crucial, but it's simply not happening. This doesn't mean that the women are doing something wrong. I think the problem is more that the older men are not really doing their job. The traditional way of raising sons, which lasted for thousands and thousands of years, amounted to fathers and sons living in close, murderously close proximity, while the father taught the son a trade, perhaps farming or carpentry or blacksmithing or tailoring. The love unit most damaged by the Industrial Revolution has been the father-son bond. There's no sense in idealizing pre-industrial culture. Yet we know that today many fathers now work 30 or 50 miles from the house, and by the time they return at night, the children are often in bed and they themselves are too tired to do active fathering. The German psychologist Alexander Mitscherlich writes about this father-son crisis in his book called Society Without the Father. The gist of his idea is that if the son does not actually see what his father does during the day and through all the seasons of the year, a hole will appear in the son's psyche, and the hole will fill with demons who tell him that his father's work is evil and the father's evil. The son's fear that the absent father is evil contributed to student takeovers in the 60s. Rebellious students at Columbia University took over the president's office, looking for evidence of CIA involvement with the university. The students' fear that their own fathers were evil was transferred to all male figures in authority. A university like a father looks upright and decent on the outside, but underneath, somewhere, you have the feeling that it and he are doing something demonic. That feeling becomes intolerable because the son's inner intuitions become incongruous with outer appearances. The unconscious intuitions come in not because the father is wicked, but because the father is remote. Young people go to the trouble of invading the president's office to bridge this incongruity. The country being what it is, occasionally they do find letters from the CIA. But this doesn't satisfy the deeper longing, the need of the son's body to be closer to the father's body. When the demons are so suspicious, how can the son later make any good connection with adult male energy, especially the energy of an adult man in a position of authority or leadership? As a musician, he will smash handcrafted guitars made by old men. As a citizen, he will take part in therapy rather than politics. He will feel purer when not in authority. There's a general assumption now that every man in a position of power is or will soon be corrupt and oppressive. Yet the Greeks understood and praised the positive male energy that has accepted authority. They called it Zeus energy, which encompasses intelligence, robust health, compassionate decisiveness, goodwill, generous leadership. Zeus energy is male authority accepted for the sake of the community. Zeus energy has been steadily disintegrating decade after decade in the United States. Popular culture has been determined to destroy respect for it, beginning with the Maggie and Jiggs and Blondie and Dagwood comics of the 1920s and 1930s, in which a man is always weak and foolish. From there, the image of the weak adult man went into animated cartoons. The father in contemporary TV ads never knows what cold medicine to take. And in situation comedies, the Cosby Show notwithstanding, men are devious, bumbling, or easy to outwit. It is the women who outwit them and teach them a lesson, or hold the whole town together all by themselves. This is not exactly what people want. Many young Hollywood writers, rather than confronting their fathers in Kansas, take revenge on the remote father by making all adult men look like fools. They attack the respect for masculine integrity that every father underneath wants to pass on to his grandchildren and great-grandchildren. By contrast, in traditional cultures, the older men and the older women often are the first to speak in public gatherings. Younger men may say nothing but still aim to maintain contact with the older men. Now we have 27-year-olds engaged in hostile takeovers, who will buy out a publishing house and dismantle in 6 months what an older man has created over a period of 30 years. Jung said that when the son is introduced primarily by the mother to feeling, he will learn the female attitude towards masculinity, and he will take a female view of his own father and of his own masculinity. He will see the father through the mother's eyes. A friend of mine mentioned that he realized when he became about 35 that he didn't really know his father. His father had been living in Seattle for 10 years or so. So he flew to Seattle one day, went to his father's house, knocked on the door, and when his father came, said to him, "I want you to know that I don't accept my mother's view of you anymore." I said to him, "What did the father do?" He said, "Well, my father burst into tears and then said, 'Now I can die.'" Since the father and the mother are in competition for the affection of the son, You're not going to get a straight picture of your father out of your mother, nor will you get a straight picture of your mother out of your father. Some mothers send out messages that civilization and culture and feeling and relationships are things which the mother and the daughter, or the mother and the sensitive son, share in common, whereas the father stands for and embodies what is stiff, maybe brutal, what is unfeeling, obsessed, rationalistic, money-mad, uncompassionate. So the son often grows up with a wounded image of his father, not brought about necessarily by the father's actions or words, but based on the mother's observation of these words or actions. I'm not saying that all fathers are good. Mothers can be right about the father's negative side, but the woman can also be judgmental about masculine traits that are merely different or unexpected. Eventually, a man needs to throw off all indoctrination and begin to discover for himself what the father is and what masculinity is. For that task, ancient stories are a good help, because they are free of modern psychological prejudices, because they have endured the scrutiny of generations of women and men, and because they give both the light and dark sides of manhood, the admirable and the dangerous. These powerful energies inside men are lying like Iron John in ponds we haven't walked past yet. It is good that the divine is associated with the Virgin Mary and a blissful Jesus, but we can sense how different it would be for young men if we lived in a culture where the divine was also associated with a being entirely underwater, covered with hair. When a man gets in touch with a wild man, a true strength may be added. He's able to shout and say what he wants to say in a way that the 60s or 70s man is not able to. The ability of a man to shout and to be fierce does not imply domination, treating people as if they were objects, demanding land or empire, holding on to the Cold War, the whole model of machismo. Women in the 1970s needed to develop what is known in the Indian tradition as Kali energy, the ability to say what they want, to dance with skulls around their neck, to cut relationships when they need to. Men need to make a parallel connection with the harsh Dionysius energy that the Indians call Kala. Our story says that the first step is to find the wild man lying at the bottom of the pond. We could ask, why not stop here? We have a young man who has stolen the key from under his mother's pillow. He has escaped from mother and father, and he is in touch with the wild man, and through him the wilderness. Like Huck Finn, he has started, quote, down the Mississippi, unquote, on a raft with a companion from a different world. But if our story describes initiation, we know we have still to deal with some sort of wound. The breaking of a bone, a puncture to the skin, a making of wound patterns in the body, that's all part of it. Mircea Eliade, in his reports of initiation experiences in dozens of cultures all over the world, mentions that the initiation of boys begins with two events. The first is a clean break with the parents, after which the novice goes to the forest, desert, or wilderness. The second is a wound that the older men give the boy, which could be a scarring of the skin, a cut with a knife, a brushing with nettles, a tooth knocked out. But we mustn't leap to the assumption that the injuries are given sadistically. Initiators of young men in most cultures make sure that the injuries they give do not lead to meaningless pain, but reverberate out from a rich center of meaning. Early adolescence is the time traditionally chosen for initiation to begin, and we all recall how many injuries we received at that age. Something in the adolescent male wants risk, courts danger, goes out to the edge, even to the edge of death. In our story, then, the boy's finger hints of wounds each of us have already received in our attempts to let the wild man out of the cage. Old men don't give us the wound. We do it ourselves. Whether the old men of the past scar us with a seashell or tattoo us painfully, or we do it ourselves, the scar stands for a wound that's already there, some missing tooth that we've each felt with our tongues. The wounded finger in our story stands for a wound most young men in our culture have already received. Let's go back, then, to the story. We are leaving our time now. There are places where time moves more slowly than here. We honor all four directions, east, west, north, south. And we also honor the fifth direction, the vertical one, which is in us here today. When the wild man had reached the dark forest once more, he took the boy from his shoulders, put him down in the earth, and said, "You will never see your mother and father again, but I will keep you with me, for you have set me free, and I feel compassion for you. If you do everything as I tell you, all will go well. I have much gold and treasure, more than anyone else in the world." The wild man prepared a bed of moss for the boy to sleep on, and in the morning took him to a spring. "Do you see this golden spring? It is clear as crystal and full of light. I want you to sit beside it and make sure that nothing falls into it, because if that happens, it will wrong the spring. I'll return each evening to see if you've obeyed my order." The boy sat down at the spring's edge. Occasionally, he glimpsed a golden fish or a gold snake, and he took care to let nothing fall in. But as he sat there, his wounded finger was so painful that without intending to, he dipped it into the water. He pulled it out instantly, but he saw that the finger had turned to gold, and no matter how much he washed it, the washing did no good. Ion John came back that evening and said, "Anything happened with the spring today?" The boy held his finger behind his back to keep Ion John from seeing it, and he said, "No, nothing at all." "Ah, you've dipped your finger in the spring," said the wild man. "We can let it pass this once, but don't let that happen again." Now, if we are to live in this story, rather than merely observe it, we have to ask ourselves, what wound do we have that hurts so much that we have to dip it in the water? Initiation, then, for young men, amounts to helping them remember the wound. And by that, we mean the soul wounds, or the injuries to the emotional body. Sometimes the outward scars exist to remind us of inward scars. Some blow usually comes from the father, one way or another. Not receiving any blessing from your father is an injury. Not seeing your father when you are small, never being with him, having a remote father, an absent father, a workaholic father, is an injury. Michael Mead found an African story in which the hunter father takes his boy hunting with him one day. Having killed a small rat, he asks the boy to keep it. The son, in the story says, thinking it was nothing, threw it in the bush. No more game comes along that day, and at dusk the father asks the boy for the rat so they can cook it and have something to eat. The boy says to the father, "I threw it in the bush." And then, according to the story, quote, the father took up his axe and hit his son, who was knocked unconscious, and the father then left the boy lying where he was. Men who hear this incident know in the most astonishing detail where that axe blow hit. One man says the axe hit on the left side of his head. Another said it landed in the chest area. Another, in my groin, and so on and so on. Almost every man remembers that blow coming in. So, this event seems to be a part of father-son material. The father gives a blow, and the son gets it. And it's a wound the boy remembers for years. And what of the blows from the mother? "Oh, you're very frail, you know. You shouldn't play with those boys. If you don't stop that, I'll send you to a foster home. See how you like that? Now you're acting just like your father." The father gives his son a vivid and unforgettable blow with an axe, which has the hint of murder in it. Many a mother makes sure the son receives a baptism of shame. She keeps pouring the water of shame over his head to make sure. These wounds come into us whether we honor our parents or not, whether we are good or bad. Many of them we can describe as wounds to our grandiosity. When we are tiny, we have the feeling that we are God. Our kingly life in the womb pointed to some such possibility, and if anyone, once we're out, tries to tell us we are not God, we don't hear it. This early sense of our godliness we could call infantile grandiosity, and we need to distinguish that from greatness or true grandiosity or grandeur, which is a part of us also. At any rate, as adolescents we still have enough infantile grandiosity, so we imagine we can decide whether the rat is big enough to keep or not. Then, when the father hits us with an axe and leaves us lying on the ground, We find our condition, wounded, on the ground, difficult to reconcile with our fantasy of princehood. We usually solve the problem by inflating ourselves further. A little ascension takes us above it all. Perhaps some grandiosity or godlikeness is useful in protecting ourselves when we are very young. Alice Miller remarks that when abuse enters, when the parents do cruelties the child cannot imagine any parent doing, it takes either a grandiose road or a depressed road. If we take the grandiose road, we climb up above the wound and above the shame. Perhaps we do get good grades, become the one in the family hired to be cheerful, become a sort of doctor of our own suffering, take care of others. Something prodigious carries us away. We can be cheerful, but not very human. If we take the depressed road, we live inside the wound and inside the shame. We are actually closer to the wound than those on the grandiose path, but we are not necessarily more human. The victim is an imposing person, too. The victim accepts the crown of victimhood, becomes a prince and princess in another way. Sometimes men with no fathers take these roads.